Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
You are Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Millions of Americans wake up each morning to their clock radio, drive to work in their surround sound-equipped car, check their multiple email accounts, surf the web, read the papers, and then, after a long day, catch the news as they head back home to flick on the tube. This hour, On Point, living the media life like it's never been lived before. First, we begin in Israel, where there have been major developments in the last hour at the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem and at Yasser Arafat's compound in Ramallah. Joining us live from Ramallah is Harvey Morris, Jerusalem correspondent for the Financial Times. Hello, Harvey Morris.
Hi, how are you?
Well, we're fine. You sound like you're in the thick of it in Ramallah. What's going on there?
I'm right in the middle of Arafat's compound at the moment. It's absolutely crowded with people who've come out. Bulldozers are already clearing the rubble of the roadblocks left by the Israelis, who've only been gone in the last half hour. And cars are streaming out of the compound. Arafat's inside. He's been speaking already about his distress at events in Bethlehem, which is about 20 miles up the road from here. And it's all very chaotic. A few Palestinian flags being waved outside the compound by men in military fatigues. Guards standing at the door with their Kalashnikovs at their side. And I wouldn't say a festive atmosphere, but certainly a lot of relief after a standoff that's lasted for months and a confinement for Arafat of almost 5 months.
Harvey Morris, are there now any Israeli troops in sight of Arafat's compound in Ramallah?
No, they've gone. They've gone, and the roadblocks are coming down very rapidly. The place is absolutely shrouded in dust from the bulldozers moving the earthworks out of the way. The last Israeli troops I saw was about an hour ago. They were pulling out on an APC with a big Israeli flag on top of it.
It's been a tumultuous night. What do you hear from Bethlehem and the Church of the Nativity? We have reports of a fire there and firing. What's going on?
Well, it seems to have calmed down now from what I hear. I was there earlier today. There was one man shot today. Then apparently the firefight started around midnight, and actual fires were set inside the compound. It looks as if maybe the Palestinians thought there was a raid on the church, and they fired, and the Israelis fired back. Anyway, it's been very tense there for the last couple of days, but things seem to have sorted themselves out now.
What about the detainees who are in Ramallah, the point of contention there? Have they been taken away by the Israelis?
Yeah, no, not by the Israelis. No, they were taken away by British and U.S. Diplomats. They were taken in bulletproof cars to Jericho, which is about 12 miles away on the Dead Sea. And now they're under guard by those U.S. And British guards.
Yasser Arafat has said that he believes rockets were fired into the Church of the Nativity by Israeli forces. Is there any evidence to back that up at this point that you're aware of?
Well, no. There were explosions near the church, whether it was rockets, stun grenades, nobody really knows. It's a very confused situation, and nobody can get near the church. I, in any event, am quite a few miles from all that.
Is there any sign of Yasser Arafat yet? Has he emerged to speak to the press or Palestinians?
Inside the compound, he hasn't come out yet. He plans apparently tomorrow to make a tour of Ramallah to see the extent of the damage that's been caused in the invasion of the last month.
And have you been inside the compound? Have you seen what the conditions were there?
No, I'm about 10 feet from the door, but there are an awful lot of people in the way. Maybe when we've spoken, I might try and see if I can get in.
Harvey Morris, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Harvey Morris is Jerusalem correspondent for the Financial Times. He spoke with us from Ramallah. 100 cable stations at the tip of your remote, the endless waves of the internet, music, news, and talking heads everywhere telling you what to buy, what to do, what to think. The presence of media all around us all the time has become an everyday part of life in America. Our guest tonight says this media overload comes at a price and asks if we're ready to pay it. In his new book, Media Unlimited, Todd Gitlin says the media does more than surround us. He says it's actually become our life. Are we totally immersed in a media-saturated, speed-addicted world of nonstop stimulation? Have Americans learned to experience and understand the world primarily based on what they experience on TV, the web, the radio? Is the media now the way we live? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from New York by Todd Gitlin. He's professor of culture, journalism, and sociology at New York University and author of the new book, Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives. Good evening and welcome, Todd Gitlin. Todd Gitlin, are you there?
Hi there.
Hi, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And with us in the studio tonight is guest news analyst Sarah Chase. She's reported for National Public Radio from France, the Balkans, and Afghanistan. She's now working for a public policy nonprofit organization in Kandahar. Sarah Chase, great to have you with us again.
Thanks for inviting me.
Todd Gitlin, we've all heard a lot about the media for a long time. Your book makes the case that things our relationship has risen to a new order of intensity. It's almost creating a new kind of life. Tell us what you're seeing about the media that Marshall McLuhan hasn't already told us.
Well, McLuhan had great insight into texts. He was interested in the content very little and interested in the form of media very much. I think what was brilliant about McLuhan was that he understood that the form had a weight all its own. But what was less than brilliant about him is that he actually wasn't very curious about how people lived. So he made big assumptions that everybody read the same way or everybody watched television the same way. So he made big prophetic and I think rather overblown proclamations that the world had become a global village and television was cool and the medium was the message and so on. And the closer you looked at these propositions, the more they dissolve. What I dare think that I've done in my book is to look at how people are actually living with media and what's going on with them that they find such satisfactions that they do find in media. And to make a big story into a soundbite, I think that the main thing people are doing when they connect with media is having feelings. This is an aspect of the experience that McLuhan wasn't interested in because he had a sort of cognitive bias. He thought of people simply as thinkers.
And of course,
I think that people are feelers and that what they want from media is a kind of low-level, flat, limited liability, disposable feeling. There it is in a bite.
And you make the case that nonstop stream of feelings and fits and starts from the media has nearly become a substitute or the stuff of life itself.
Well, on the face of it, the number of hours people spend is with not just with television, but radio and CDs and the internet entertainment world and billboards and elevator music and video games and all the rest of it. This is the major thing that people do. I mean, this is rather staggering to get your mind around, and that's one reason why I think many people think that there's no story here. But if we add up the hours that people are spending doing one or more of these things at once, much of it at home, but often out in the world and even at work, this is the major thing we do. And I think this is not the picture we have of what we're about in our civilization. We like to talk about our values. But I think that more important than values as affirmations is what people actually do with their time. The time is the most precious. Time is what is who you are. You want to know who I am, then look into how I spend my time. And this is what we do.
But human beings have always retreated into story, into song. You write yourself about poetry and song across medieval Europe and broadsheets and Gutenberg and movable type and all of that, about even in Don Quixote, a farm worker sitting around listening to someone reading books found in a trunk. It's not as though it's a new experience for humans to give themselves over to story, fiction, imagination.
Exactly, and this means that this weird way of life that we've stumbled into wasn't just the creation of television networks or Hollywood or commercial production. But what is new is that we're prosperous enough to be able to afford the virtually nonstop immersion in this flow. The speed of the flow is ever increasing, but we're not the same human beings who devoted themselves to one story at a time or one play a year. Somebody has calculated that in the 18th century, the cost of a theater ticket was greater than a day's wage for the average laborer, whereas today you can have hours of drama in television for about 1/100th of that cost. So it's partly that the stuff is cheaper, but it's cheaper in part because the demand for it is so great. So what's different is not that we want diversion, but that diversion has become, in a sense, the main bout. It's the center activity. It's what's going on under the big top.
You write that in a society that fancies itself the freest ever, spending time with communications machinery is the main use to which we have put our freedom. Is that a problem, Todd Gitlin?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think that it's a problem at two levels. First of all, the very fact that we're doing it and we're rather oblivious of the fact that this is how we're living is a distraction from the truth. I mean, I think we're evading who we are, and that troubles me. But I think there are more particular problems. I think that we have, for one thing, a sort of national attention deficit disorder. You know, we're on to the O.J. trial, and then we're on to Chandra Levy, and then we're on to Princess Diana, and then we're on to Survivor 2, or we're on to the drama of the disappeared girl or what have you. And this, I think, ill-equips us to govern ourselves. I think it distracts us from our discipline, our duty, our common bonds with others. It puts us in separate camps, little containers that seal us away from people who are not like ourselves. And although we talk a lot about community, we're actually more interested in hanging out with people who are more or less like ourselves. So I think our civic life is weakened by this. I think also it's not an accident that in this nonstop entertainment world that we have growing numbers of kids who literally can't sit still. Who are, diagnosed as victims of attention deficit disorder. But attention deficit disorder is what's being cultivated by what is really the de facto curriculum of our time, which is that this nonstop world, the average kid is in the presence of these media for about 6.5 hours a day. And I've been told by teachers that often a kid, whether in an inner city school or a fancy private school, comes to school having already been plunked down in front of TV or video games or other such equipment for a couple of hours, and wanting the teacher, expecting the teacher to wiggle and flash the way the media do.
So you don't see this, Todd. You don't see this, Todd Gitlin, as just another step in human evolution. You see it as stepping into some kind of pit here.
Well, I don't know if it's a pit. I mean, I'm not altogether that apocalyptic about it. There are certainly benefits. There's stuff that comes down this torrent, which is worthy and which ignites inspiration and reflection and all kinds of other good things. But I think there's something of a weird skew in the lives we're living. There's something of an imbalance between the other things we might be doing and this life. And I think this life is in many ways impoverished. It's impoverished in a sensory way. I mean, we're stuffing our eyes and our ears, but we're neglecting our other senses.
So I want to turn to Sarah Chase just before the break. Sarah, you've spent time all around the world. Do you see Americans having a different experience from the French, from the Afghans?
The Afghans, certainly. I mean, which is where I was most recently. It's almost the reverse, where you've had a society that's been deprived of these sort of media stimuli. And as a result, they do more things. Now, some of those are equally diversionary, like playing cards or bopping eggs on top of each other to see which one cracks first. But what's happening now is a kind of explosion of media being poured into a society that's not so used to it. And there is something drug-like about it. You see whole neighborhoods neighborhoods gathered at the one television glued to it.
We're talking about the media flood, Media Unlimited, as our guest tonight, Todd Gitlin, calls it. Do you feel overwhelmed with media? Do you like it? How much of your daily experience is vicarious media experience? Is it half? Is it more than half? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life in the media flood, about how images and sound and news overwhelm our lives. In fact, perhaps our guest tonight, Todd Gitlin, says, become our lives. What do you think? Is the media flood a bad thing or just part of human evolution? Are we losing touch with real life? And what is real life? Is media part of it or a seductive substitute? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Todd Gitlin, the media that you describe, most of them, the Internet, I guess, excepted, have been around now for quite a while. When did, in your view, and you've been writing about the media for a long time, when did we cross the line? When did this go from being diversion to the big show, the main stuff?
I don't think there was a big bang moment. I think it's been swelling. I mean certainly when television filled 90-95% of American households, that was in the late 50s or early 60s. I'd say that was an important moment when we crossed over. And by the way, just to fill out an answer to your last question, you asked about France, and we got into Afghanistan.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you discover when you look at the numbers is that the Americans are ahead of most countries, most rich countries, in the amount of media that we do, but we're not that much ahead. The French, for example, famously resistant to American type of entertainment, watch 40 or 50 minutes less a day of television, but they're still way over 3.5 hours. The Japanese actually watch more than we do. So it's not simply an American problem. It is, in a sense, I don't know, evolution makes it sound a bit too bland and passive. I think it's a disposition that has become the equivalent of a comfortable life in prosperous countries. And I think, it has its benefits. Again, I don't want to drag us into the swamp of apocalypse here. There are certainly worse ways of life, and they're certainly more painful and there are more intense forms of suffering. This is a luxury. These are the problems of the rich. But that's not to say that it's evolution in the sense of the life that cannot be exceeded. It's not the best of all possible worlds. I think it would be rather demeaning to think so.
And yet, you say it's not apocalypse, but you say it's distraction from the truth, avoiding who we are, perhaps avoiding what the world is. That can be a pretty dangerous way to go.
Well, it can be extremely dangerous, and now we're getting to the most egregious shortfall, which is insofar as we are ensconcing ourselves in our home entertainment centers. There are all kinds of things we're not doing by way of governing ourselves or taking care of our collective wheel. So, in a sense, we're buying on the cheap an exercise in sort of reaching an escape velocity from the gravitational pull of reality, which is at some level what we want. I differ with those who think this is all imposed by Michael Eisner and Rupert Murdoch. I think that we have been headed in this direction for a long time because the desires that we cherish and take for granted are desires that could be met on a rather skin deep level, and so in a sense this is exactly what we've been angling for, but
for a long time.
I mean, I would say centuries. I would say that people, the people who went to the inn described by Cervantes in the early 17th century to hear somebody read a book would have been thrilled at the thought that someday they could have people reading books to them or performing dramas for them umpteen hours a day.
Well, Sarah Chase, Todd Gitlin makes the case that as soon as we become rich enough to do it, we reach for escape velocity. We reach for the media alternative to the real life that's under our feet right outside the door.
Well, I guess that was one of the responses I was going to have. Is he mentioned that this is a luxury. It's a problem of rich societies. And I wonder whether part of it has to do with comfort. Is it sort of more comfortable to, let's say, look at Mount Everest on, you know, an internet screen from your desk than it is to look at Mount Everest from Mount Everest.
Certainly warmer to do it that way.
For example. And so then, you know, we sort of forget that the experience is much less intense than it would be if you were freezing on Mount Everest. And I guess the other question that he's posing, that Todd Gitlin is posing, is where in the past we might be able to say that those people who went to the inn were expanding their experience to
listening
some
extent. Listening to Cervantes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. They're expanding their own experience by taking in the experience of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Is what's happening now that we're replacing experience with, as you put it, vicarious experience.
And in effect, limiting our experience of the real world.
Yeah, and activity, the sort of alternative to sitting and watching or taking in media is actually doing something. So, again, the kid in the presence of media for 6 hours a day, on the one hand, you can say he or she is bombarded. On the other hand, you can say he or she is extremely passive compared to the kid who's going out in the woods and, you know, making arrowheads or something.
Todd Gitlin, you say that the media bubble we live in is not only a distraction from the truth, but it actively puts a weird skew, in your words, on reality. What is that skew? Are there constants in it?
Yeah, it's a skew toward sensation, electricity, spectacle, a kind of low intent. I mean, this is paradoxical. It's all the things, but in a comfortable way. Sarah used the word comfortable, and I think that's exactly part of the appeal of this, that I can do all this without, you know, putting on my shoes. I don't have to get dressed. I don't have to do anything. I just have to be in the reception zone. And this is, obviously this is the lazy person's route to distraction. And, you know, once upon a time you had to be a king to afford it. And now, you know, virtually anybody in the rich world can afford it. And I think you're also exactly right that there's, in an important way, a subtraction from the possibility of experience, that this is not although it feels like a gift, and nobody should underestimate the degree to which people are grateful for all these marvelous little glittering moments that stream out of our technologies in order to distract us. But it is, in a way, a subtraction, I was suggesting before, from our entire sensory experience. After all, we're not doing much with our noses, you know, or our skin or our taste while we're doing all this. And parenthetically here, it's inevitable in these discussions that the subject of September 11th comes up. And I think it's very interesting. As somebody who lives about a mile from Ground Zero, I'm acutely aware that while the quote-unquote experience that you could get through television or radio, you know, was lurid and unforgettable, there's a very important aspect to the experience that is concealed from you.
That was not just a telephone drama, a television drama. That was an olfactory drama.
Exactly. You smelled it.
Mm-hmm.
And the smell is central, indelible to my version of that experience.
We're talking with Todd Gitlin about Media Unlimited, the media bubble that he says is consuming, perhaps becoming, our lives. Do you control the TV remote control, or does the TV remote control you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Michelle is on the line. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, media, it can be used as another form of drug. People become addicted to it. I think that it has its uses. We, after all, are seekers of pleasure, you know, as the animal species that we are.
Do you feel yourself mainlining media sometimes, Michelle?
No, absolutely not.
Because, you resist it?
I'm resistant. I try to pick and choose. And I think that a lot of the focus that we're talking about is television. But whether it be the newspaper, I read the articles that I choose to read. I switch the channel. I turn it off. I watch very little television, and I try to make what my family watches in some level of educational. But I think that, you know, like any drug, we can get too much of a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it depends on the individual, and we really need to be careful.
Michelle, thanks for your call. Todd Gitlin, Michelle is resisting, but it's a pretty powerful wave. It's not easy to resist the media reach these days.
Well, everybody tries to resist in little ways. I mean, people tend not to be proud of the number of hours they watch television, and they sort of go to considerable lengths to to point out that they are resistant. The resistance is something that everyone feels the need for because of the sheer sensory bombardment. But it does make sense, I think, to think of this as a drug in the sense that it takes more over time to give you the same reaction that you got initially from a smaller dose. And in the sense that many people wish they were less susceptible. Many people feel worse after they've watched television, although they thought they were watching it in order to feel better. And in this, in the sense that people wish that their wills weren't paralyzed, or they are, I think, having something like a drug experience. But as the caller pointed out also, you know, the drugs up to a point actually are serviceable, and people turn to them because they make them feel good. And that's one of the perverse paradoxes of our situation. The stuff, in a certain sense, makes us feel good.
And, of course, at a certain level of intake, there are legitimate, genuine pleasures and entertainments here, and that's part of life, too. I want to turn to Robert Thompson. He's professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University. Bob Thompson, jump in on this conversation with us. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So
I have to say that I spent the afternoon, turned off the TV, turned off the radio, had no media input, and read Media Unlimited from cover to cover.
And it's still media. You can't escape it, Bob Thompson. So what's your take is Todd Gitlin is warning us that we're sliding into an alternative media life. Do you buy it?
Well, my favorite metaphor that he uses is the idea of how people use the word media as a singular and use that grammatically incorrect. But in fact, maybe there's a truth to that because there is this whole sense of media as the air we breathe, literally the culture as in a petri dish that we're in. And it does have a certain monolithic feel to it. I guess on one level, though, so I agree with that description, and it reminds me of some of the novels of Don DeLillo, White Noise, for example, which so brilliantly and poetically describes this. I think I'm a little less pessimistic about it, however, in that I think one can, in fact, sometimes miss the trees by looking at the forest, in that we're also surrounded, for example, by the air we breathe, and we can certainly be distressed by this, the quality of that air, pollution and toxicity and all the rest of it. At the same time, there's good stuff in that air we breathe. There's oxygen and nitrogen and stuff we need. What we need to do is ferret out the carbon monoxide and the other toxins and so forth, as opposed to implicating the entire thing we're in.
So you're saying that this is a viable environment for good human life, you're saying?
Well, I'm saying there are times in this totally media-saturated environment where I'll go through a day and I'll hear an insight on NPR that's very useful to me. I'll be in the dentist office and start digging a song that plays. I think ultimately what, as educators, we most have to do is to teach a sense of discrimination. And if we implicate all of the media environment in its entirety, the sense of discrimination, in fact, gets pushed aside.
Todd Gitlin, how about it? Is the human mind capable of the kind of filtering? When media stimulus becomes as great and diverse as it is now, perhaps we're still capable with our formidable minds of filtering, of taking on what we want and letting the rest kind of bathe over us without being absorbed.
Well, so we imagine. I think that we pay a price for this immersion, which we, I think, would rather not contemplate, namely that we're exerting energy even to fending off what we don't want to take in. I think that we're still, in a sense, there's a pressure to this environment that works on us. But look, I don't want to argue that it's all the wages of sin or that the atmosphere is nothing but toxic pollutants. Obviously, that's not true. Whether you think this is on balance healthy or unhealthy, my main intent in the book is to make the situation look as weird as it is. That is to say, I want to say that this is not how human beings have lived for the most part in history, that it's extremely weird That weird can be also marvelous, but it's extremely weird.
And let's be aware of that.
And let's be aware of that. And let's consider whether this is really how we want to live. That's my purpose. If you want to go away and say that on balance, you know, it's...
We're happy to be weird, so be it, but it is weird.
Fair enough. But I'm saying, you know, let's just stare at it.
Yeah, and it's a very provocative challenge to stare at it. Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I kind of disagree with what's been said here. I believe that most people watch media, and this goes way back to 36,000 years ago when media was really a song around the fire, mm-hmm. for cerebral reasons, for expanding. I mean, your mind is constantly active in everybody, you know, from when you're one day old on, and I think people do it to expand their mind.
So you don't think we're swept away in a flood? You think it's a deliberate partaking of the media that we want?
Absolutely. I mean, watching Mount Everest from the internet is watching Mount Everest from the internet, and you do it because you want the cerebral experience. You're not doing, you know, you're not there, and you buy into that. It's not, you know, I think people do it for a cerebral reason. Essentially pornographic material that ever came out in the world, sensationalism is so to hook the buyer.
It hooks the buyer, all right. I think we've got you, Mike. Bob Thompson, how about it? Mike essentially says, hey, we are creatures of free will, and we will exercise it in the direction we like, and we'll dip into this media stream for cerebral satisfaction. And what's wrong with that?
Well, I think that's true, although I think it takes a lot of training to do that in a way. We're not always as capable of doing that in our own best interests as we may wish we were. I mean, a lot of this stuff is material that you simply can't get away from, and as discriminating as you might be, it's there every place. The other thing, though, that I would say is what comes from this total saturation is all kinds of little holes in the wall, little open doors, which allows other things in. For example, this kind of conversation going on for an hour, some of the best insights I've heard against the media, in fact, indicting the media, have in fact taken place on the media. That's where most people hear them. Saturation coverage, for example, these endless coverage of things like Monica Lewinsky and Enron and all of the rest of it. In all that saturation coverage, one good thing does happen is that you cannot get away from it. And in not being able to get away from it, everybody had to learn a little bit more about the law than they did before from O.J., a little bit more about the impeachment process from Monica, and a little bit more about Islam from what happened after September 11th.
So it is at least punctuated with insight.
Yeah, and that inescapability means that none of us can get away from it. Now, that's not to say there aren't prices paid for that, because I think there are, but there are also benefits in this whole equation as well.
Bob Thompson, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, thanks.
Robert Thompson is professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University. Sarah Chase, what do you hear in this whole tossed salad? We are surrounded by media. It is the environment of our lives. Are we deliberate? Are we making our own way, or are we sort of a prisoners in a chain gang here?
This sounds like a real cop-out, but I think that depends on who we are. I think different people use and experience the media in different ways, and different people are able to dose it in different ways, or willing or want to dose it in different ways. I would just sort of say, as a kind of offbeat reflection, that being on the other side of this mirror can sometimes be very strange, where you have as a reporter, you have the sense that you're actually condensing your experience down and sort of trying to get it through the eye of the needle, and that can be quite odd.
You live it and then turn it into something consumable. We're talking about the media flood, Media Unlimited, with Todd Gitlin. Are we lost in the music, the movie, the tube, or are we just finding a new way? Are you addicted to media? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Todd Gitlin, author of Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives. We're talking about the media flood we all live in. How much of your daily experience is vicarious media experience? Is it half? Is it more than half? Are we losing touch with real life? What is real life? Is media part of it or a seductive substitute? Do you control the TV remote or does the remote control you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to say, first of all, this is one of the more satisfying and fulfilling hours of the media I've experienced in a while.
We're glad to be a bright spot.
I suppose I have more of a comment than a question. I just returned to the States after living in various European countries for about 10 years and have really just been overwhelmed with the extent and the pervasiveness of media and advertising, just the clutter that fills my life, my day-to-day life back in the States. My mother said, ultimately in frustration because she wants me to stay in America, you know, Chris, you need to learn how to ignore it, which I think is ignoring is filtering. And filtering sounds nice, but I think I agree with Todd that it takes a lot of effort.
Chris, do you find it more difficult to filter or to live a life apart from media here than you did abroad? Why?
Well, I lived for 7 years in the UK and wasn't therefore hindered with language there. Partially, and NPR aside, I think the quality of the media is better over there. Mm-hmm. So there is a quality issue. Mm. But second of all, it's things like airports in America. You can't go to an airport without constantly hearing either a very short, you know, soundbite news program or advertising.
Yep.
And
Chris, we got it. And it's a provocative point. Sarah Chase, you spent almost a decade in Europe. I don't know if you had this experience there. I know after coming home from 10 years in Asia, every time I'd come back, I did have this feeling that, my gosh, you get into America and every nook and cranny is filled with something, rock and roll, noise, sound, image, that it seemed to kind of almost block up your pores when I'd come home.
What I find is the biggest change is the Internet, and that's where the difference seems to me to be the largest. I mean, in France, which is where I've been, people listen to the radio all the time, the way they do here, if anything more. There are fewer television channels, but people do. A lot of politics happens on television, even more than here. But the Internet, it really hasn't caught on yet. And so you don't have this sort of glued to the screen and everyday activities happening like shopping or looking up telephone numbers or you know, ordering pizza on the Internet.
Steve is calling from Amherst, New Hampshire. Welcome, Steve.
Well, I'm very happy to join all the media addicts talking about the media.
Okay, welcome to the club.
Our naval contemplation.
Right. Exactly. But one of the points that I had, and of course, you know, every one of us who listens to this show every night as we're driving home from work are usually getting the political diatribe. And I'm just wondering to what extent, to pick up on one of the last points that was made, the people on the other side of the media, to the extent that you feel perhaps co-opted by staged events that find their way into this, you know, this myriad that everybody gets exposed to who is listening.
Well, that's an interesting twist, Steve. Our time's running down. Let me put it to Todd Bitlin. Todd, does this great mechanism of media, Steve's essentially asking, does it get manipulated so that the media that we live within is not just not reality because it's entertainment-focused, but that it's actively turned into a kind of manipulation, even a miscasting of what's going on in the world?
Well, you know, everywhere, people who produce news or entertainment are in the attention-getting industry, and they are trying to grab hold of your lapels and get your attention because your attention is what they sell to advertisers, and that's true in England or France or anywhere else. There's more. It's unbridled in the U.S. It's less controlled. I actually got off the last got out at the end of the Mass Pike going up to Boston a couple of weeks ago and discovered an ad that was attached to my receipt at the toll booth, and I stayed in a hotel in Cambridge where there was a screen on in the elevator, and you know, somebody's paid for my attention. So you know, we are rather uncritical of that, and we rather think that it's a sort of proof of our freedom that we indulge such things. Now, so everybody who goes out to get our attention is, in a sense, manipulating our attention. They're laying hands on it. That's what manipulating means. Now, are they lying? Are they creating, you know, did Peter Jennings lie, you know, a while ago when he told us that Arafat was in Ramallah? You know, is Arafat actually in Paris? No. It's not like that. And in fact, that I think misstates and it fails to give credit to the power of these industries, because if the industries, especially the news business, were in the business of lying, you know, people would catch on. People would understand, as they did, for example, in communist countries, when there were communist countries, that you know, you should, if you want to, in order to know what's going on, you look at television and you sort of turn it up.
I think the opposite,
and,
but here there's enough truth that we keep tuning in. I want to get one more call. Marissa's on the line. Welcome, Marissa. Our time's running down. Make it quick.
Okay, I'm the director of the Computer Addiction Study Center at McLean Hospital in Boston, and I see a lot of the people who can't resist these things. This is the people who stay online constantly. These are the people who are cajoled into staying on games.
You think society is encouraging a kind of addiction?
Absolutely. That is my general feeling about it. And I see, unfortunately, I see a minority of people, because not everybody, plenty of people can turn this off.
But some can't.
But many can't. And that's now because we're so connected to all forms of media, games, internet, porn, you name it. All the organizations, all the industries are pushing this.
We've got it. Marissa, Todd Gitlin, there's the report from the front where the problem becomes an actual real psychological problem.
Well, this is extremely important. And let me add to what we just heard the following, I think, rather devastating statistic. If you ask people who watch television, do you watch a specific program or do you just turn it on and watch whatever's on? In 1979... the percentage who said, I watch whatever's on, was 29%, and that's high. But in 1995, one generation later, that percentage had gone up to 43%. Okay, it went up by 50%. 43% of the people say they watch whatever's on. I call that addiction. And by the way, the more you are, the more, if you are the person who watches whatever's on, you're less likely to be involved in civic activity. You're less likely to be registered to vote. You're less likely to vote. Now that, you know, somebody before was talking about cerebral activity. Maybe I'm less cerebral than the callers and some of you folks. I think mainly what's going on is that we're feeling, and we tell ourselves
that we're
listening for information because that flatters us.
Todd Gitlin, we're out of time, but you've made us think a lot tonight.
I'm glad.
We appreciate it. Thanks for coming
for
on.
I appreciate it.
Todd Gitlin is author of Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives. And Sarah Chase, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation on our forums. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, our audio archaeologist digs up songs about technology. This is On Point. Long before the dawn of the information age, new technologies were changing how people lived, how they talked, how they thought, and how they dreamed. The telephone, the TV, and the railroad were revolutions. Tonight, our on-point audio archaeologist, Ned Connors, has a diary about the songs these technologies inspired and some thoughts about why there are no hit songs about DVD players and computers today.
Nobody sings about computers. In the 60s, we sang about cars, about auto engines.
A four-speed dual-quad positive traction 409.
We raised our voices in song about transmissions, carburetors, differentials, cubic inch displacement. We've always sung about technology, trains, airplanes, bicycles. But these were technologies that enveloped us. They took us places. We could sense the noise, the steam, the exhaust, the wind in our hair. We also sang about information technologies. They didn't engage us the way trains or cars did, but we wrote songs about telephones, phonographs, radio, even television. Before commercial radio, we had wireless telephony, telephones without wires. Here's Billy Murray in 1916 singing about an expensive wireless telephone call to Hawaii.
For I had to phone every little thing I own, from New York to the wireless telephone. Oh, hello, how are ya? How are you? Goodbye.
A story that kept turning up in the popular music of the teens and 20s was the idea of using new means of communication to talk to a departed loved one in heaven. In 1904, we heard Hello Central, Give Me Heaven. When radio came along, we had the same idea. Here's Arthur Fields in 1923 singing, I Wish There Was a Wireless to Heaven.
I wish there was a wireless to heaven, and I could see the mama every day. I would let her know by the radio.
In the 1930s, the Carter family put an interesting twist on things. They sang about Jesus tuning us in on heaven's radio.
And I know without a doubt, Mama's prayer will bring you out, for my precious Savior always listens in. Heaven's radio on the other shore, for my precious Savior always listens in.
We also sang about the limitations of technology. We sang about static. Long before FM, we had nothing but AM radio, and passing cars or summer atmospheric disturbances tormented early radio listeners. Here's the Seven Champions singing about static in 1926.
I twist it, I turn it, but all I just gotta learn it, it's static, static.
I twist it, I turn it, and all I get gall darn it, is static.
I'd better stick to my phonograph record.
In the late 20s, sound came to motion pictures. And we sang about it. In this oddly voyeuristic song, a fellow wishes he had a talking picture of his girlfriend. Here's Ralph Haynes in 1929, If I Had a Talking Picture of You.
If I had a talking picture of you, I would run it every time I felt blue. I would sit there in the gloom of my lonely little room and applaud each time you whispered, I love you, love you.
When experimental television first came along in the 20s and 30s, some believed that the people on the other side of the screen could see you too. When country artist Red Foley sang about television in the late 40s, he had no such illusions. But he was troubled by the fact that whenever he skipped a day of work or innocently hugged a lady bystander at a wrestling match, he kept getting caught on the diabolical small screen.
The phonograph and radio are really mighty nice, but now they brought out something new, a C&I device. I never get a break at all since this thing come along. Each time I alibi, this lie detector proves I'm wrong.
Television is the devil's doing. Rocky ruin.
So where does this leave us in 2002? We spend much of our workdays in front of a computer, arguably the most intrusive technology ever to enter our lives, and we don't sing about it. Today's musicians and recording studios use computers to make music, and the sound of pop music today is driven by computer-sequenced rhythm. But where are the songs about screaming modems, roomy hard drives, big monitors? I think we might be deeply ambivalent about these boxes. They do so much, but they've only managed to raise expectations, to hurry things along. No one seems any happier. And who are the folk heroes of the information age? Bill Gates? Steve Jobs? Hackers? How would you like your daughter to come home and say she found true love with a hacker? I don't know about you, but I don't think we like these people.
It only takes a key to stroll from your telephone.
in time we'll make some peace with computers. We'll know when we start singing about them.
On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.